Bom dia a todos e todas. Sou Rodrigo Torres, diretor de Educação Executiva da ENAP, e queria dar as boas-vindas a vocês ao primeiro Fronteiras e Tendências da ENAP de 2021, agora repaginado no formato mais dinâmico, mais interativo, mas sempre tentando trazer nomes que são referências internacionais em políticas públicas que são estratégicas, prioridades para o país. E, em especial, nós queremos dar as boas-vindas àqueles altos executivos de governo que nos acompanham. Agora, transmissão mais democratizada, aberta no YouTube, mas ainda com todo o cuidado para os nossos altos executivos, são os líderes do governo federal, mas também a todos aqueles que se interessam pelas temáticas com as quais a gente trabalha e que estão aqui prestigiando a gente. Então, muito obrigado. Em 2021, a ideia era trazer um pouco mais de um gostinho de presencial para vocês. Estamos aqui falando da ENAP, para vocês poderem matar um pouco mais a saudade da escola. E a gente queria desejar as boas-vindas ao Frontend em 2021. O nosso convidado de hoje é uma pessoa que a gente já queria trazer há algum tempo. É o Daniel Gerson, que é o chefe da Unidade de Emprego Público e Gestão da OCDE. A OCDE, hoje, o principal organismo multilateral que busca criar padrões, estabelecer boas práticas de diversas políticas públicas, inspirando os diversos países a produzir melhores políticas públicas para os seus cidadãos. E, em especial, o Brasil tem se inspirado muito na OCDE no estabelecimento da sua política de gestão de pessoas. Recentemente, nós lançamos o conjunto de competências essenciais de liderança para os altos executivos do setor público, e isso inspirado a partir de um peer review que fizemos em conjunto com a OCDE. Então, é muito importante ter o Daniel aqui com a gente hoje. É um prazer ouvi-lo e escutar um pouco mais sobre o que ele tem a dizer. E para debater sobre esse assunto com o Daniel, nós vamos ter hoje o presidente da ENAP, Diogo Costa. O formato de hoje é um pouco mais interativo, então é mais um bate-papo, e a gente espera muito que vocês participem também, contribuam, e a ideia é que a gente possa fazer essa troca de forma muito fluida e aproveitando a presença do nosso convidado. Thank you so much, Daniel. Diogo, está contigo. Muito obrigado pela presença.
Obrigado, Rodrigo. Bom dia também a todo mundo que está nos acompanhando. O tema de hoje é super interessante para a gente discutir lições da OCDE em gestão de pessoas. A gente tem um convidado super especial, Daniel Gerson, que é um grande parceiro nosso, é alguém que realmente está na fronteira do que está acontecendo em gestão de pessoas e que tenho certeza que vai ser uma conversa super interessante hoje. A gente vai ter essa conversa em inglês. Daniel, welcome.
Thank you. Bom dia.
Bom dia. Thank you so much for being here. Let's get this thing rolling. Let's begin by talking about leadership. In a recent publication, you present a proposal for grouping leadership competencies into four categories: leadership based on values, open inclusion, organization management, and network collaboration. How can these skills ensure greater effectiveness in delivering public services?
Thanks for asking about this publication, which is a working paper that can be downloaded from our website, and perhaps you can share the link with as many people as you'd like, so you can get more of the full picture of all of this. But I think the answer to your question is partly in the methodology we use, because in fact we started by asking the question of what skills are senior leaders using to actually address complex policy issues and to manage complex, huge public service organizations. And we did this by working with about 10 different countries on case studies where senior civil servants were working together to address common challenges. We worked in Finland with senior civil servants who were trying to put in place a bunch of challenging projects that were part of the government action plan, And all of these projects involved working across ministries, across organizations to actually achieve their goals. We worked in Canada on questions around the inclusiveness of leadership and how they could be more inclusive for an increasingly diverse population and workforce. We worked with the Netherlands looking at how senior civil servants could actually be partners with communities and work together there. And in all of these cases, we tried to kind of catalog through various different interviews and discussions the different skills that we heard people talking about and that they were essentially demonstrating to us. And that's what developed this model. So if we, and the model kind of goes from the inside out, if you will, essentially, you know, values, being a values-based leader means understanding what your own values are. What does success look like? What does it mean to be effective in this world? And what the values of your organization are? What kind of values do you want to impart through your organization? And what we know in the public sector is that these are not always very straightforward, right? Because you have values that are both achievements, but also it really matters on how we achieve things. Already the achievements is complicated because we're not just going to maximize profit and become the biggest entity we can, which is generally, you know, the basic purpose of private sector organizations. But we're there to do so many different things at the same time. Even within one organization, there can be lots of different programs and business lines that may sometimes be competing and have trade-offs and difficult values judgments. And then we're also trying to work in a way that is much more open, that's much more transparent, that's much more accountable. So all of these kinds of values tend to come into play as well. So as an individual, you know, as an individual leader, there are lots of values conflicts that come into play every day. And any discussion with a senior civil servant in any of these countries brings forward these values conflicts very quickly, that they have to, as an individual, be able to somehow juggle, right? There has to be some clear sense of what it is they're trying to achieve, why this is important, how they're going to go about it, et cetera. And to make that even more complicated, they have to be open and inclusive. And this is the second group, because an individual senior civil servant, their own value systems can never be perfect. They don't have all the information. They don't have all of the points of view. There's never any perfect information. So they increasingly need to look around them at who they're working with, at how they're bringing in voices and skills and views from other groups, how they're actively looking for the voices that maybe they're not hearing from, not used to hearing from, and making sure that those voices are heard and that they are able to challenge their own perceptions. And then, you know, we place these people at the head, at the top of big international or big national organizations, sometimes international. And we want them to be a leader of an organization. And this is where we get into the organizational stewardship. So not only do they need to direct the organization to do what they think is right, you know, this very traditional top-down view of leadership, which is still very much alive and well in the public sector, but they also need to build this organization. They need to invest in this organization to make sure that it has the health that it needs, the people that it needs, first and foremost, and that those people are well taken care of. And it needs the data, the tools, the digital technologies, the whatever it is, right? So we're asking these people to be values-based decision makers, to be open and inclusive, but also to be essentially building these public sector organizations of the future. And then that's not even enough, because once they're doing that, they also need to be able to see the world that they're working in as a range of systems that they're just one part of. Their whole organization, no matter how big it is just one part of a much more complicated system that is trying to achieve some kind of public value. that has to recognize all of the other actors in those systems, be able to understand who is doing what and how they can use various different levers and collaborative tools to engage with those systems to actually achieve objectives. And so in this sense, the model tries to go sort of really from that inner values view through, you know, this open, inclusive mindset to the head of a big organization that can then connect in a systemed, networked sense to everything else to actually achieve impact. And so that's the short answer to your question. How can these four skill sets be used to advance public policies?
That's great. And it's always hard to teach leadership, right? And to select for good leaders. Have you seen around the world good examples of leadership teaching, of capacity building on based on these skills?
Yeah, that's a great question. We looked at some of the different models in different contexts, and what we tried to emphasize, so this report also goes into what are the different tools to build these leadership capabilities, et cetera. I think we have to be clear on two different modalities. So one, which most people focus on as a first answer to your question, is let's train the senior people. Let's make sure that the senior people all have the right courses and backgrounds. But frankly, I think if that's your main focus, you might be arriving too late at the party. Because once these people are in place, there's two things. I mean, most of these people are great people. And they think they are. They know they are. If that's why they're in place. So what more do they need to learn? How do they get anything out of a training? That's a little bit the skeptical answer. The answer is that these people are very constrained time. They have very specific problems, very specific challenges. So what we often hear from them is, when I went to this course, it was half a day on digital leadership. Fine, I mean, I get the theory, but the examples didn't relate to my day-to-day reality, et cetera, et cetera. So what we've seen happening at that level, the most senior people, is a much bigger focus around coaching, around mentoring, and around peer coaching and mentoring. So learning from each other, creating opportunities for reflection. The Netherlands has three core competencies for their senior civil servants, just three. It's integrity, collaboration, and reflection. And I love this simplicity and the focus on reflection, because it recognizes that we all need to be learning. I mean, any good leader recognizes that they're always learning. But they can learn from just taking a step back and reflecting on what they're doing, what they've done, where they've come along, what worked well, what didn't work well. And being able to find a way to structure that reflection, perhaps amongst their peers or with professionals, is a very strong learning opportunity. But like I said, if we're only focusing on this group, we're sort of arriving too late, because people who we should really be focusing on the pipeline, right? Those people who are probably going to take on these kinds of roles in the future, who are working their way through the system, who show a lot of strength and potential. And there, you know, there's a lot more opportunity to really mold them as they go through their careers, to look at managing this pipeline in an efficient way, putting together not only training, but actually in integrating kind of a performance management perspective, a talent management perspective, a career development perspective. And I think that's really unfortunately, one of the underinvested elements in a lot of public services that we work with.
That's great. Switching a bit of gears, how should we think about good practices that work well while they're small. And one can think of Free Agents, the program for labor mobility in the public sector in Canada, but they are hard to scale.
Well, it's an interesting challenge. And I mean, it's one that I wonder if it's really a problem or not, right? Small things are great when they work well. And there is a lot of good room for things. I mean, I think generally when things happen at the smallest level of that they can, they tend to work better. But of course, it depends on what the problem is, and it depends on the scale of the problem that the solution is looking to solve. In some cases, we've seen practices that start as experiments. So you mentioned this mobility program in Canada. It really sort of started as an experiment and has expanded to a few different areas. But as you say, it may not be the future primary operating model of the country. And that's okay. There are a lot of beautiful things that can happen at a small level. We have to be careful not to always rush to do the big thing, because in a lot of organizations, big things fail hard and fall heavily down. So it's a balancing act. Do you have anything specific in mind in this context?
Well, Brazil is a big country, so whenever we think of pilot programs, we usually don't think of keeping them small for long. We usually think of letting them grow. And this has always been a challenge. We've seen this with the pandemic and some policies and practices within the Ministry of Health that all of a sudden had to grow to encompass a whole country of over 200 million people. So usually that's what many people have in mind when they start with pilot programs, is how to think of letting them scale up.
Yeah, sure. And that can be a useful ambition as long as you have the right infrastructure in place and the right people in place and the right support and in place. I mean, the other option is just to recognize that what worked well in one area may not be the solution for all areas. And so perhaps scale doesn't actually have to mean a one-size-fits-all solution. Sometimes scaling down is the solution, but that means having to let go of central power, of central control. And that can also be difficult and challenging in a large country.
Excellent. Let's talk about digital transformation. And digital transformation government has been taking off for a while now, but many people don't see this converting to productivity gains. I don't know if you agree with this, but if so, why hasn't information technology boosted more productivity in the public sector?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. But I mean, it's one that maybe I would challenge some of its fundamental assumptions, because in fact, we've never really figured out how to measure productivity in the public sector, to be completely honest. And, it's quite difficult to then say that digital technology hasn't increased productivity. You're right in that, you know, the amount of people who work in the public sector, for example, has been relatively stable for the last many years, or even grown, depending on the country, depending on the situation. But I think what we expect the public sector to do is also growing. And so it's hard to just take a look at a statistic like that and say that we're not improving productivity. If I remember seeing an image of a Ministry of Finance tax collection office that was taken in like the 1960s, and it was this huge room full of women and men all sitting at different tables together with little adding machines. And you could see that they were going through each person's tax return and basically just calculating it in this enormous room. And I don't think those rooms exist much anymore. And those people have been replaced by machines. And in most cases, we have far less manual labor doing simple calculation exercises on paper-based systems, at least in the tax offices that I'm aware of. So I think, you know, if we just anecdotally want to think about how technology has shifted, I think it has changed the public sector and probably produced more productivity in more ways than we realize. But, you know, there will never be quite the same full transformation potential at the same speed as, say, an equivalent organization in most private sectors. And again, it depends on which country we're talking about, because usually the public sector workforce has a different set of requirements, has a different set of expectations, and it's not as easy to replace them with machines in a legal sense. Often it's not the kind of work that is as replaceable by machines either. Sometimes there are very sticky collective agreements, legal scenarios. So I think that would be sort of my initial answer to your question or response.
And Daniel, do you see you're cautiously optimistic, I suspect, about digital transformation. But from now on OECD countries, what do you see as what kind of technologies do you see as having more potential for increasing work productivity, even if we don't know exactly how to measure it?
Yeah, I'm probably not the best person to answer that question. We have a team of experts working on digital government that see a lot of excellent work being done in sort of front-facing service delivery and back office integration, in data, you know, data being able to develop better and more informed policies, also in people management, of course. So, you know, we see a lot of potential, and I think a lot of countries are already putting it into practice in various different degrees. But you know, I think there's good reasons too why things happen a bit more slowly in the public sector. In some cases, we have to hold ourselves to a higher standard of care. We have to make sure that these tools aren't going to be putting citizens at risk. We're dealing with bigger risk issues, right? We're not just here providing a platform to watch movies. We're here providing healthcare. We're here providing security services. So it makes sense to me that public sectors would take a more measured approach, a slower approach, learn from what they see happening around them. Not to say that that's a reason to sit back and rest idly by as the rest of the world transforms and jumps up. And in many cases, governments probably are acting slower than they could. And there's probably a lot of reasons for that. But, you know, some of the other issues that are really around the skills of the public service. How do we make sure that public servants are actually keeping up with those kinds of skill sets in implementing, being able to implement and make the best use of these digital tools. And that's something that a lot of the HR structures, the hiring structures that we've developed in OECD countries weren't necessarily developed for the current challenges, the current moment that we see happening. And the ability to really get people with the technological expertise needed.
A question from one of our viewers, Thais Almeida. She wants to know more about leadership development in the Netherlands and is asking for any suggestions of where to look for that.
Well, we have a case study that we have developed, which is summarized in the report that I mentioned earlier. We also have, there's a longer version of that will be available soon in our website. So that can be made available easily.
We'll also add links to that in our YouTube channel. Okay, Daniel, how do we avoid government agencies to be run completely by lawyers?
Stop hiring only lawyers is the simple answer. This question has a different answer in different contexts in different countries, or has a different purpose, right? Because in many countries, it's not lawyers that are the main and principal employees in the public sector. In the country I come from, in Canada, it's certainly not primarily lawyers. But I know that in Brazil, it's a very legalistic public sector, as is in most Latin American countries, that is the case. You work in a system where the law dictates what you can do versus other systems where the law dictates what you can't do. When the law dictates what you can do, it makes it challenging to actually find and understand that space you have as a public manager for innovation. So when we were doing some work in Brazil earlier, around innovation, this question often came up, and it seemed like the answer was, to embrace lawyers and to find good lawyers, lawyers who know how to help clarify that space and ensure that the gray zones become a little bit clearer, to reduce some of that risk that people take on when they're trying to make change happen. However, a law degree isn't a guarantee of leadership potential or of transformational vision. We don't advocate that all public servants be lawyers in Brazil, but having some good lawyers on side with you seems to be a helpful point of departure.
Definitely. I have a law degree, so anything be said in favor of that, I'm okay with it. Jurema Pereira is asking about OECD innovation when it comes to public integrity and risk management.
Yeah. How the people are engaged, including higher managers. In this particular moment, in this crisis, is this the reference? We've been looking at the different kinds of leadership challenges at this moment in time. So we began talking about these four leadership competencies. And of course, one big debate, because this work was done before this current pandemic, is, in times of crisis, does this change? In times of teleworking, does this change? I mean, right now we're most public services are still mostly teleworking. What does that mean in terms of the ability to be values driven, to be open and inclusive? Open and inclusive is an interesting challenge because I think in many cases we become more insular when we're not in an environment where we're actually together in the same place or able to travel or able to actually be face to face with those who can challenge our assumptions. We have to actually do more effort to reach out and connect and collaborate and coordinate. Same thing with an organizational development, right? We don't even really know what our organizations are anymore because we've moved to this virtual space. It's clear that leaders and managers are needing to find different ways of connecting with their staff, different ways of connecting with their partners, using more online tools. I think many of the managers that I know, and myself included, spend even more time than ever talking to people. I think we spend even more time now talking to people than we did when we knew that they were just in the office next door, because somehow it gave us more of a sense of awareness just to be in the same building together. So I think that, you know, that goes a long way to ensuring that we're still finding ways to build and impart values. How do we bring in new staff into a virtual organization? How do we make sure that new staff understand the kind of values that drive the organization in a virtual environment are huge questions that we're still sort of feeling out as we go.
Well, we talked about lawyers. Let's talk a little bit about consultants. So what is the value that management consultants add in public service? To many people, it's almost absurd that you have these young people with no public sector experience come in and tell public servants what to do. But many decision makers still believe that it's a solution to many problems. So how does this work? What's the value that they add?
Well, it's hard to paint an entire huge industry with one brush, of course. I think where I would sort of look at this question is that public servants, particularly, you know, when we're working in a relatively insular organization, that public servants tend to be quite inward looking. It's really important to be able to get outside perspectives, get challenging, you know, have your work challenged by somebody else, somebody who might come from academia, who might come from a consulting company, who might come from an international organization like the OECD. It's really important to be able to hold your work up to a mirror and to see how it may appear in an international context or when it's being benchmarked against internal factors and things. So there is certainly a value for bringing in an external perspective. What I think is interesting and potentially troubling is the growth and the use of consultants for things that have traditionally been done by civil servants. On the one hand, you know, I work on public employment. That's our main focus. Well, is a consultant working for a government public employment, right? What is the link or the limit between where the public employment ends and the next kind of extension of that begins? And in some countries, there seems to be an increasing reliance on the work of private consultants as a replacement because there's hiring freezes on the public service, et cetera. And that might be okay in certain situations. There are always, but what we've been trying to push for is more of a principled approach to it. So why is it that we're hiring a consultant rather than giving the job to public servants? Can we be more consistent with that reasoning? In some cases, it might make a lot of sense. In some cases, you might be looking for a skill set that you need for a short period. It might be a skill set that is very specific, that's going to be out of date in a few years anyways, that may or may not, you know, be worth investing in the long term, which is okay in that case. You know, what we try to dissuade is that you have consultants and civil servants who are doing exactly the same job in exactly the same way. Just one happens to be in a certain status and the other another. So I think what I'm looking for and what I'd love to hear more about from public managers is this sort of decision tree, right? When is it that we should actually be reaching out to the private sector to provide services? And when is it that we should be doing it ourselves? What are the factors that should push that decision-making process?
I want to also ask you about the role of public servants in generating trust in government. And many people see that one of the results of the current pandemic is that civil society has had more trust, has seen civil servants as being more reliable than before. So what do you think is this role that public servants play in building trust?
Yeah, it's another great question. And it's one that's so pertinent right now, because I think while we see the trust in government anyways was going down, and then it started to rise a little bit across OECD countries in the last couple of years. And now, you know, it's an open question, and we'll see how things get resolved in the next months with vaccination strategies, et cetera. But all of this plays a big role in public trust. And of course, at the front end of that are public servants in many cases. Now, sometimes they're consultants. So it depends on the system, of course. But we've seen, you know, significant research that suggests that there are specific trust-based impacts from the quality of a service that somebody receives. So it's not usually a great strategy. If you want to gauge trust in public services, or you know, gauge trust in the public sector, it's hard to just go ahead and ask that question, right? If you say, "Do you trust the government?" people usually immediately jump to their political representatives. Do you trust the public sector? I mean, it sort of feeds into sometimes some stereotypes about lazy bureaucrats who are just in it for themselves. But in certain situations, would you call the police? In certain situations, would you go to a hospital? In certain situations, would you expect to receive emergency care? You know, these kinds of indicators can tell you that, well, those are public services, and they're the ones that are quickly responsive. So the OECD did some interesting research on this, and they found that a lot of trust in the public service can be brought down to two broad groups of indicators. And this kind of goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning of this discussion. One of them is the kind of integrity of the public service. So it's the values that the public service brings forward. The how is the work actually done? Integrity, accountability, openness, and transparency are you know, themes around this. So the more people see their public service as being as working openly and in an honest way, the more they will trust them to deliver. And then the other one is the competence of the public service. So what is, you know, do the services actually match the needs of people? And are they delivered in a way that is actually timely and responsive to those needs? And both of these are very much at work and at play in the development of trust. So that means that a public service that is seen as employing public servants who have skills and values that are the right skills and values, right? If I, as a citizen, think that my government is full of people who are motivated by the public good and who are in their position because they're highly skilled and well-trained, then I will probably trust them to actually deliver on what I need them to deliver on. If, on the other hand, I believe that my public servants are all there because they have connections, friends in high places, or you know, are there because of a favor, I don't think I'll trust them as much to be able to actually deliver on what I need.
Rita Beko wants you to contextualize the four dimensions of leadership when it comes to, in the context of the current pandemic and managing teams in remote work.
Well, I mean, as I mentioned before, I don't think the big debate is, you know, whether it really changes anything or not. The big challenge, of course, it depends on the work you're doing completely and the context that you're doing it. But of course, the big challenge is just in being able, as a team leader, is being able to connect with your team, to be able to have open and honest discussions and understand people's day-to-day reality. It's not really any different than we had before. This morning, I was actually in a conference and somebody was presenting on some statistics coming out of Germany, which were showing that during this period of home working, people were wanted individual consideration from their leadership. And they wanted sort of understanding of their individual circumstance. And that they didn't feel that necessarily that they were getting that during this pandemic. And the question that came to my mind, which I didn't have a chance to really articulate, was, well, isn't that sort of the case even when we were working in offices, right? So I'm not sure that a lot has changed in terms of being able to be a good leader, a good manager, because it still comes down to your relationship with your team, your relationship with individuals, and your ability to bring people together around and motivate and listen and be open. The modalities have changed. And perhaps the cleavage, the space between those who get it and those who don't really do it has become even greater, and maybe we've shone sort of a big spotlight on some of these issues. My feeling is that when we move back to a new working environment, whatever that's going to be, my guess is it'll be some combination of home working and office-based working, and each organization will find a new equilibrium where they want to be, that those feelings will continue. And in fact, I would suggest that they'll be even trickier to manage, because, you know, before the pandemic, most public sector organizations that I'm familiar with were working primarily in an office-based environment, some people working at home a couple of days a week, one day a week, maybe not even, you know, here and there. Everybody assumed that the norm was being in the office. Then we had a pandemic, everybody went to home working. So then the norm, all of a sudden, everything is focused on home working. Everybody working from home, everybody connecting through their Zoom accounts or their Teams accounts, and everybody on the same equal footing. But the next phase, the hybrid phase, is going to be the most challenging one, because there, managers are going to be challenged to figure out how to balance the presence with the remote. How do you make sure that you're finding ways to and still be open and inclusive and team-based when half of your team is sitting in the room next door and the other half are connecting through online platforms? This will be the next challenge, and one that I think presents a lot of risks. Either you get the best of both worlds, which is of course the objective, but it's very possible you end up with the worst of both worlds, and that would be a difficult place to be.
Yeah, I agree. I've been thinking a lot about how to build a organizational culture when everyone is remote. You know, those moments before meeting, or especially after meeting, where there's that little talk that sometimes solves problems, but also builds culture. This becomes much harder when you're just clicking to go out in a meeting. So I completely agree. I think the biggest challenges are still ahead. I wanted to ask you about this term, vetocracy. So Esther Klein wrote in a Vox article that Americans, the institutions through which Americans build have become biased against action rather than toward it. They've become, in political scientist Francis Fukuyama's term, bureaucracies in which too many actors have a veto rights over what gets built. That's true in the federal government, it's true in state and local governments, it's even true in the private sector. And by building, he means even building education, building healthcare. Do you think that his that bureaucracy is actually something that has a real meaning in the public sector? And if so, how should he think and deal with this?
I remember when I at the beginning of my time at the OECD, I was speaking with somebody who was an expert seconded with us, and she had been a very senior civil servant in one of our member countries, and told me that to get anything done in government, you have to be willing to listen to about 100 no's before you get to a yes. And you just have to keep going. So I think, yes, you're right that this idea that my power allows me to say no is perhaps somewhat endemic to many public sector organizations. Public sectors are by nature conservative, and because there's a lot that can go wrong, and we're increasingly in a context of high political volatility of media and social media that tend to pounce on negativity and take things in certain contexts and spin them out of control. So yeah, it's a challenge. I mean, there's no simple solution. What I think about in this context is a triangle that is of three elements. Of course, a triangle has three sides. One of them is objectives, right? We need to be able to give leaders, managers, individual civil servants, but especially sort of at higher levels, objectives that give them a mandate to change something, a mandate to innovate, a mandate to actually go and improve an area. Goals and objectives, performance objectives in that sense are very powerful, strong tools to be able to get to a yes, because it's written in your performance agreement, it's written in your job statement, you know. But objectives alone aren't going to get you very far. Then you also need to be given a certain level of autonomy. So that's the second side of the triangle. Autonomy to be able to actually make the decisions you need to make as a manager to be able to achieve those objectives. But we can't just give objectives and autonomy. We also need some level of accountability. And so that's the third element of this triangle. And it's a tricky one to get right, especially in the public sector, as I said, that have both a higher degree of accountability to the public and a higher degree of transparency, a higher degree of political consideration. And very often we give objectives without giving the necessary levels of autonomy, and autonomy and accountability have to be well balanced to be able to get there. And so for me, that's the answer is somewhere in this triangle. But the devil is always in the details, as we say.
So related to this, you spoke a bit about this status quo bias that you find in public service. And the OECD has brought important aspects of the future of work in public place in the public service in a recent publication from December last year. And it suggests that public service should be more forward-looking, flexible, fulfilling for a diverse range of public employees. What do you think are the main challenges of bringing the future of public work to the present of public service?
Yeah. there are so many. There are so many, but I think that there's a really good opportunity that's opening up. you know, we're coming hopefully towards the end of this crisis. I say that optimistically, at least of this initial phase of this crisis, and then we come to a huge challenge to rebuild and restructure our economies, to regenerate and reinvigorate a lot of what has been lost in this period. And that's going to require a civil service that is capable of managing these huge investments, that is capable of delivering new and better and just services to many people in the population who are really desperate to receive them. So, you know, the challenges are huge. They're everywhere, and I'm sure that, you know, we could brainstorm them for hours and hours and hours. But I would rather end with this vision of this opportunity, because what we're trying to really hope we can do with this paper is remind everybody, as if they need to be reminded, that the quality of this recovery is going to be on the backs of public servants. And what we saw in the previous global crisis and the financial crisis is that there was a tendency to freeze public employment because it was seen as sort of a cost-generating item. There was freezing of hiring, freezing of promotions, freezing of training for quite a few years, freezing of salaries. What did that end up? It ended up with a public service that is way older than its population, a public service that lost many of the good people it had because they went to other areas that they could work in and have more opportunities for career development, and ended up with public services that that had, you know, skills atrophy because they weren't training people anymore and they weren't able to really keep on top of the curve. And over the last few years, we've seen that starting to really thaw. We've seen a lot of investment now in training and in thinking through these new skill sets. And that becomes even more important now than ever. So my hope with this work is that we're able to present a very positive vision of the public service as one that has faced huge challenges in this last year, has proven that it's actually far more flexible than most people realized, and that requires further investment and support in ensuring that it can work effectively to actually now deliver the services and the reforms needed to be able to emerge out of this pandemic as a stronger institution than it started in.
Daniel, that sounds like a good note for us to end our conversation. Thank you so much for your time, for all your insights. This has been a fun. It's a pleasure to talk to you all, as always. And now I'm going back to Rodrigo.
Thank you so much.
Muito obrigado. Thank you, Daniel. Obrigado, Diogo. Acho que a gente começou muito bem o front-end 2021. E é sempre um prazer ter esse momento, né, de escuta de grandes especialistas internacionais e nacionais, em especial nessa temática de como gerir bem pessoas dentro do setor público. Queria aproveitar para dizer que esse vídeo vai estar disponível com a tradução em português no YouTube da ENAP. Então, infelizmente, hoje a gente não conseguiu ainda fazer a tradução simultânea, mas para o próximo evento nós já vamos ter a tradução simultânea. E queria convidar vocês para o próximo evento com a professora Gisele Ziglac, que é professora da Escola Nacional de Administração Pública Francesa, da ENA, uma das mais tradicionais parceiras da ENAP ao longo dos tempos, e falando sobre liderança feminina, justamente na semana que a gente comemora o Dia Internacional da Mulher. Então, acho que tem muita coisa para a gente conectar sobre liderança, e ela é um dos grandes homens a falar sobre isso. Então, queria fazer esse convite para vocês, dia 10 de março, quarta-feira, nesse mesmo horário, todos juntos. E muito obrigado, até a próxima edição do ENAP Fronteiras e Tendências.